You began by making a reputation as a cynical iconoclast. Would you say something about the process that took you to your interest in unorthodox religion?
I was always interested in the descriptions and philosophies of the mystical life. I remember as an undergraduate reading Jacob Boehme and having various Catholic friends who were who knew a certain amount about the mystical tradition in Catholicism, and I read a fair amount at that time. Then I, with sort of mixture of admiration and hostility,
with derision,
not with derision, but with a good deal of skepticism and with a great deal of fascinated interest, and then I came to read more and meet numbers of people who knew about Oriental material, read a good deal of that, and came in touch with men who'd had some first-hand experience. And this interests me now very much. I mean, this is making the best of both worlds. This utopian fantasy I've just finished is about a society in which, owing to historical accidents, there has been a mingling of Western with Oriental influences, so that both sides are developed and an attempt is made to get the best out of both sides. Many serious philosophers like Northrop, for example, The Meeting of East and West, is a frightfully dull book, but it's a genuine, serious attempt to make some kind of a synthesis.
But aren't Eastern ideas and presumptions utterly different from ours?
After all, in the past, there have been plenty of syntheses between East and West. I mean, Christianity was one, after all. Neoplatonism certainly got a good deal from the further East, which became a very important stream in Christianity. I don't think they are utterly different. I mean, did you read a book which I think is a very good book by this Englishman who's lived for many years in Japan and taught there, Blythe, called Zen in English Literature? A very good book. And pointing out, how much there is in English literature, which is profoundly Zen-like. I mean, Wordsworth is full of Zen, and Whitman is full of Zen. And many, many people have this sort of attitude towards nature. The Japanese artistic representation of it, both in landscape and in the haiku, is perhaps more refined than anything we did, and more sort of elegant. But nevertheless, it's of the same order, it seems to me. I mean, in a curious way, I would say that, intellectually speaking, the shortest way to India from the West is via Japan and the Far East. Because, I mean, we share with them this kind of nature mysticism which the Indians never developed. And, I mean, the Indians, after all, never developed a landscape art, where the Chinese developed it 1,000 years before we did. And it's possibly the most wonderful religious painting in the world, the great Song landscapes. So I don't think there is anything profoundly alien. I mean, this does represent a deliberate attempt to cultivate perception and imagination, to cultivate these non-verbal sides of the total human organism to their highest pitch of refinement and awareness.
Surely, Zen is just the kind of inward turning which makes for cushioning an otherwise intolerable existence.
But Zen isn't really all inward turning. I mean, it's outward turning in some ways. I mean, it's both inward and outward. It's after all, this nobody's been more acutely aware of landscapes, of flowers, of birds than the Chinese artists. And this does represent a whole, Japanese artists too, represent a whole social attitude towards the external world of seeing infinity in a grain of sand. I mean, the Blake poem exactly sums up what they were after and what they so consummately succeeded in doing. I mean, this is simultaneously outward and inward, which seems to me the most desirable state you can possibly have. The Japanese landscape art was 200 years later than the Sung landscape art, which was the early expression of Zen in the Far East and the expression of Buddhism. They have their religion in Shintoism. They have various Buddhist sects which are full of ritual and symbols and so on. But they do have, and there is a certain element of this in Christianity too, this idea of a non-dogmatic, non-symbolic, I wouldn't call it religion, I just call it an approach to the universe. I mean, they're not worshipping anybody particularly, but they're just, this is the way they want to respond to the universe with the maximum of sensibility, with the greatest perception of these, of the mystery within the explained and understood world. I mean, again, this is making the best of both worlds, to understand as much as you can and to label and to classify, but at the same time, behind the labels, to perceive the fathomless mystery of existence, which is the whole essence of Zen, it seems to me. And in this respect, I feel that this approach to the fathomless mystery is far better than the, say, the Vedanta or the Hinayana Buddhist approach, which consists of this contemplation, which is intense concentration, therefore almost universal exclusion of everything. I mean, the whole point of the later Mahayana doctrine is that it includes things. I mean, it permits you to live in the world, but perceiving the absolute, perceiving nirvana, not outside the world, as the arhat does in the Hinayana tradition, but perceiving it within it and realizing it in acts of work and love. I mean, I don't know any higher ideal of life than that. I mean, it seems to touch on every level, on the ethical, the philosophic, the artistic.
What part has the supernatural in your life?
I don't exactly know what people mean by the supernatural. I mean, in practice, I would say that what people call the natural in our Western tradition is, in fact, our projection of concepts upon the world. I would say this is the natural is our tendency to project our notions and concepts upon the outer world. I mean, to see the outer world not as the immediate datum of experience, but as an embodied label, as the illustration of some generalization already pre-existing in our skulls. This is what we call the natural world. The supernatural world, as far as I'm concerned, is in effect the genuinely natural world, which is the world of immediate experience without all these concepts imposed upon it. I mean, anyone who has ever had the experience of seeing the world without labels and concepts immediately has the impression of its being supernatural. And I mean, in a curious paradoxical way, nature as it is in itself, in as much as we can ever know it in itself, is supernatural. The all too natural is this all too human world of concepts which we impose upon nature. And this, as far as I'm concerned, is the difference between the natural and the supernatural. The natural is what we is our picture of the world with its names and its labels imposed upon it, the utilitarian and scientific and generally day-to-day picture, and the supernatural is the world as it comes to us in its profoundest mystery. One is sometimes suddenly aware of this bottomless mystery of existence. I mean, suddenly you're hit by this thing. If you choose to call this the supernatural, and I don't know what other sense it has. I mean, I don't believe in mysterious beings going around and arranging things, but I do believe in the profound, unfathomable mystery of life, which I think has a sort of divine quality about it. I think there is a mysterious being, but whether he goes around arranging things is another question. I just don't know. I mean, I think one can be complete agnostic and a complete mystic at the same time. I don't see any incompatibility with mysticism and the most skeptical scientific approach. I mean, there's no incompatibility, just as there's no incompatibility between being a biochemist and having a taste for music. I'm entirely on the side of the mystery. I mean, any attempt to explain away the mystery is ridiculous. This fundamental everyday mystery of our existence is something which we mustn't try to avoid through intellectual explanation. We have to have intellectual explanations, but we have to be perfectly clear that they're not completely satisfying, that we must never take these words too seriously. Words are very important, but if we take them too seriously, we destroy everything. But if we can somehow learn to make the best of both worlds, the worlds of conceptual explanation and the worlds of immediate experience, the world of the mystery as it's actually given, then we have a full and complete life. Otherwise, we have either the life of the sort of savage without any intellectual side at all, or else the so-called life of reason, which is wholly unsatisfactory. We have to have both. We must make the best of both worlds. And the Greeks did pretty well up to a point, but I mean, the Greeks had their appalling limitations. I mean, their whole view of women was utterly unsatisfactory. They had no view of an adequate kind of marriage, no view of a permanent love relationship between the sexes. I mean, in that way, they were frightfully limited. But in other ways, I think they did handle the problem of the irrational very well. I don't know enough about older civilizations to know which did it well. I mean, I think many of them obviously did it pretty well. I mean, I suppose the Chinese did it pretty well. But though I'm quite sure that we could improve upon it, I don't think we do it very well. We have such bad symbols. I mean, we have really no great symbols now. I mean, all that we have are these ridiculous nationalist symbols like flags and swastikas and whatnot. But there are no sort of great cosmic symbols. I mean, when you think of the staggering symbols that the Indians produced, I mean, the dancing Shiva, for example, we never produced anything as comprehensive as this. The dancing Shiva, those little bronze statues, it is the Shiva with four arms dancing with one foot raised. I go into the details, they're really quite extraordinary. It's the figure stands within a great circle, a sort of halo, which has flames going out, I mean, the symbols of flames. And this is the circle of mass, energy, space, time. I mean, this is the material world. The great world of all-embracing material world with its flames, which are energy. Within this, Shiva dances. He's called Nataraja, the lord of the dance. And he dances, he's everywhere in the universe. I mean, this is his dance. The manifestation of the world is called his lila, his play. He sends his rain upon the just and the unjust, and he's beyond good and evil. Of course, it's all an immense manifestation of play. He has this long hair, which is the hair of the yogin, contemplative, and it streams out to the limits of the universe. You see, therefore, this sort of yogic knowledge of this contemplation includes everything. He has four arms. In the upper right arm, he holds a little drum, which is the drum which summons things into creation. You beat upon this drum, things come into existence. In his left arm, he holds a fire, which is what destroys everything. He both creates and destroys. His lower right hand is held up in this attitude, which means be not afraid, in spite of everything, it is all right. The other hand points down at his feet, and one foot is planted squarely on the back of a repulsive dwarf, this infinitely powerful dwarf called Muyalaka, I think his name is, who is the ego. And he has to break the back of the ego, you see. What he's really pointing at is the other foot, which is raised. And this means this foot is raised against gravitation and is the symbol of spiritual contemplation. The whole thing is there, you see. I mean, the world of space and time and matter and energy, the world of creation and destruction, the world of psychology. I mean, how do you get out of this? I mean, if you don't break the back of the ego, you're lost. And if you don't practice contemplation, there will be no liberation for you. I mean, we don't have anything remotely approaching such a comprehensive symbol, which is both cosmic and psychological and spiritual. I mean, it is really most unfortunate that we have such miserable symbols. It's part of the regular Hinduism, but it is specifically Shivaite. And then one of the manifestations, of course, is called Bhairava of Shiva, who is also dancing, but he dances in cemeteries. And I mean, to remind us that the dance of life isn't always very jolly. I mean, that he dances just as much in misery and death as in life and elation. I mean, this has to be accepted. And of course, again, it's only by the lifted foot that we can accept it. I mean, it actually is completely compatible with the modern scientific idea. I mean, it includes the world, you see, of mass, energy, space and time, and the idea of the infinite energy dancing timelessly and forever through this world, dancing through human mentality too. I mean, the world is felt to be, of course, a kind of outrage, because the play goes on even inside ourselves, although we are sentient beings, and yet the hand is raised, everything is finally all right, in spite of everything, if, as Buddha said, I show you sorrow and the ending of sorrow. The ending of sorrow is putting your foot on the back of the dwarf and raising the other foot against gravity into the state of contemplation. I mean, the whole thing is there, stated in this single, extremely elegant. I mean, these Shiva images from the south of India are very, very elegant. They're most beautiful pieces of sculpture, the best of them. But it's a shame we don't have any good symbols like this to remind us of who we are and of what we can do about it, if anything. No, we're very, very poor in it. I mean, we have some of the Christian symbols, but they're not really. I mean, the symbol of the cross is fairly good, but it doesn't take into account the sort of cosmic side of life. I mean, it doesn't take into account mass, energy, space, and time, which is essential. It doesn't take into account, I mean, as it stands, it doesn't take into account the importance of contemplation. No, it's, I mean, there are other symbols, of course, within Christianity which do, but a single comprehensive symbol like the Shiva symbol we do not have, and it's very unfortunate. And this whole business of the organized manipulation of symbols is, I mean, the human mind is a symbolific instrument. I mean, it exists to manufacture symbols, to turn immediate experience into symbols for the purpose of managing it in a fairly convenient way. The question is, can we get on with fairly scientific symbols, realistic symbols, and then concentrate on the immediate experience? I don't know. I mean, I simply don't know whether this is a possible as a sort of general attitude towards the world. I think it's certainly possible in isolated individuals, but whether in fact it will ever turn out to be something which appeals to great numbers of people, I have no idea.
But surely, by its very nature, mysticism hinges upon superstition.
Can one have the flowering of mysticism without the dung of superstition. I don't know whether you can. There's a very interesting chapter in Kongzi's book on Buddhism saying that as a matter of historical fact, these extremely elevated mystical and philosophical doctrines of the Mahayana have always been associated with the grossest forms of superstition. Can it be avoided? I don't know. I mean, he is inclined to think that you don't get the one except growing out of the other. I hope it's possible to have an aseptic mysticism, but I don't know that it is. I think certain people can have it, but whether there can be a sort of general atmosphere on the basis of a non-superstitious, non-dogmatic set of beliefs, I've no idea. I profoundly hope so, but at certain times I rather doubt it. The whole problem of dealing with the irrational is surely to find out means by which these irrational drives can be given their satisfaction without harming the person who has the drives and without harming his neighbors. This is not past the wit of man to devise these methods. I mean, this was something which William James years ago discussed in his essay, The Moral Equivalence of War. This is an inadequate essay, but it touches on one aspect of an extraordinarily important way of dealing with human beings. In fact, it is the only way of dealing satisfactorily with the irrational side of man. It requires satisfaction. The final, highest, most difficult problem of reason is how can we allow the irrational its proper scope within a general framework of rationality and benevolence. Empirically, all cultures have worked out various methods. I mean, the whole Greek method of menadism and Bacchic orgies and so on were all methods for getting rid of these intolerable tensions in socially harmless and even beneficent ways. The carnival, the Saturnalia, all these things are empirical devices for doing precisely this. And I think one of our troubles is that we haven't got enough of these devices now. I mean, Christianity became so wildly respectable that it gave up dancing, which was a grave mistake. It's very significant that this extremely, quote, spiritual sect of the Quakers quaked. I mean, here there was this violent, involuntary quaking movement of the muscles, which was an immense release and, so to say, an opening up of the organism to the free flow of the life force. And this was an empirical invention of great value. Similarly, that the sort of deliberate dancing processes of menadism and Bacchantism and the Dionysiac orgies were also methods for involving the muscles in this general process of release, of getting rid of these pent-up irrational drives in harmless ways. And it seems to me that any civilization which seriously takes account of man's nature has to invent these things. They've been invented again and again by primitive people, even quite advanced people, and we've made the awful mistake of dropping a lot of them. I mean, the best we can do is rock and roll, which is something which the boys and girls have had to invent for themselves. But there's no sort of social or religious sanction for this, which is the gravest mistake. Whereas in the past there was. I mean, menadism was built into the whole social and religious pattern, and so was the Bacchic orgy system. We don't have to say that when the Quakers quaked or the Shakers shook, that this was necessarily the operation of the Holy Ghost within them. I mean, after all, the Pentecost, when people behaved in a strange way, the onlooker said, these men have drunken new wine. I mean, they did behave like drunks.
But they were getting rid of tensions and permitting the life force to flow through them. I think we can talk about this in realistic terms now without necessarily invoking supernatural explanations, but at the same time, the sort of basic, what may be called the basic supernaturalism, that the, what you might call the life force, can be, you can talk of this and say that these methods, which we now know about why they happen, that they are of value in as much as they do permit this basic source of energy and enlightenment to flow freely through an organism which is constantly blocking itself up and obstructing itself by the operations of the conscious ego. These are ways of getting rid of the conscious ego, getting out of our own light, which is of course what everybody has been talking about from the beginning of time. But, and I think we are now in a position to be able to talk about it in more or less naturalistic terms and not necessarily in these supernaturalistic terms which the early Quakers or the Shakers or the Dervishes used. They're geniuses and geniuses. I mean, there are some who are content to work within the tradition in which they find themselves, and others who find it necessary to modify that tradition. I mean, after all, take the case of Chaucer. I mean, here you had a man who, out of the blue, really developed psychology. I mean, his contemporaries and his predecessors had been interested in psychology, finally, only from an ethical and religious point of view. They were not interested in the variations of human character as such. They were interested in the variations of human character as determining whether you went to hell or heaven. And, I mean, take his greatest predecessor in narration, Boccaccio. I mean, it's quite incredible, the summariness and the lack of detail of the psychological descriptions, or even the physical descriptions in Boccaccio, they just don't exist. I mean, he just said there was an extremely handsome young man in Florence who fell in love with an exquisitely beautiful girl, and this is about as far as it ever goes in Boccaccio. Then you find the later Canterbury Tales with these extraordinarily fully developed physical and psychological characteristics, which found no imitations afterwards. I mean, this extraordinary man turned up and everybody admired him a great deal, but nobody was able to follow him. These are extraordinary facts. I must say I find, and yet he's a man of his own time, but he's a man also completely outside his own time, as far as I can see. The history of psychology, it's quite obvious that people must always have been perfectly efficient, practical psychologists. People were no stupider than we are. And in their personal relationships, they must have had a very, very shrewd idea of what people's motives were, etc., etc. But, of course, their official psychology was incredibly crude. But every now and then, you've got a literary psychologist who was about 400 years ahead. I mean, of course, you've just got to compare Shakespeare and Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson, being a scientific psychologist, I mean, who followed the whole doctrine of humours as you find it expressed in Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, and there was a fully worked out psychological theory. It didn't happen to be a very good one. I mean, even a sort of psychosomatic theory too, which didn't happen to be very good, and it didn't happen to be very helpful. But nevertheless, I mean, in spite of the bad official psychological theory, I'm quite sure that most people with a reasonably good intelligence and intuition were extremely shrewd practical psychologists. They probably knew about it, but nobody had written it down. Many of the findings of Pavlov and his dogs were well anticipated, I mean, empirically. I mean, Dr. William Sargent, in his book, The Battle for the Mind, has a most interesting chapter on Wesleyan, Wesley's method of converting people, persuading and converting people, and showing that how closely it's related to these methods which Pavlov used later on with dogs, and which of course methods findings of course which proved to be extremely useful in the cure of shell shock and battle fatigue in the two world wars. I mean, there is no doubt that people empirically hit on all kinds of things, and it was only in much later times that the theoretical raison d'etre of what they were doing was gradually emerged and came into clear consciousness.
Speaking as yourself, speaking also as a member of your generation, how serious, how enduring was the impact on your mind of Freud?
I was never as intoxicated by Freud as some people were. I mean, I think, I get less intoxicated as I go on. I mean, I think he omitted so much from his purview of human beings. I mean, this fact that he really leaves out completely out of account the whole physical side of man. I mean, to listen to Freud, you would think that man had only two points in his anatomy, the two ends of the digestive tube, I mean, the mouth and the anus. I mean, nothing else exists in the Freudian anatomy at all. And yet there is a good deal in between, and we know very well that there are many things on the neurological and biochemical level which profoundly affect our minds. But Freud, and although he did himself say that he finally all nervous disorders would turn out to be organic, but he did say that in the meanwhile, until we found out some more about them, we could treat them successfully by purely psychological means. I think this is absolutely untrue. And his followers, of course, dogmatically insist upon this. I mean, in the most ridiculous way, the orthodox Freudians, well, thank heaven, the most psychotherapists are not orthodox Freudians now. They are eclectics and making use of organic and chemical methods and psychological and sociological methods which guarantee a cure, which the pure Freudian just doesn't get with his 8 years on the couch. More and more, as I learn more about what is happening now in the field of neurology and biochemistry, and in the general study of human physique and the classification of human types, I feel more and more strongly that you have to have the total organic approach. I mean, this is trying to see the thing as a totality. I mean, it's just, we have to make the best not only of both worlds, but of all the worlds. Man is a multiple amphibian who lives in about 20 different worlds at once. And if anything is to be done with him to improve his enjoyment of life, to improve the way he can realize his desirable potentialities, to improve his health, to improve the quality of his relations with other people, to improve his morality, we have to attack on all the fronts at once. And we have the greatest, what may be called the original sin of the human mind, is sloth, it's oversimplification. We want to think that there is only one cause for any given phenomenon, therefore there is one cure. There is not, and this is the trouble, that no phenomenon on the human level, which is a level of immense complexity, can ever have a single cause. I mean, we must always take at least half a dozen conspiring causal factors into consideration. And any attempt to improve human life has to take into account the psychological factors, the sociological factors, the physical factors, the chemical factors, all of them. Practically, you see, I mean, the trouble with the Freudians is that they took only one set of factors into account. Well, of course, their system doesn't work at all well in practice. So that this, as I say, is the sort of intellectual and scientific correlate of my feeling that the highest forms of art are those which impose a kind of harmony and order upon the greatest possible number of sectors.
Don't you think that by the 19th century, by Victorian times, although there was all this injustice and horror, there was a beginning of social consciousness? There's a considerable drive towards amelioration of social conditions, and a lot of reforms took place.
I remember years ago going to look at the mummy of Jeremy Bentham at the top of the big staircase in University College in Gower Street, going with Schweitzer to see it. And one opens the door, and there sits this sweet little old gentleman with, he has a wax face and his silvery hair which falls over his shoulder, and a bottle green swallowtail coat with brass buttons and striped cotton trousers and varnished pumps, smiling at one. And Schweitzer looked at him for some time and said, "Oh, I'm always so very, very fond of Jeremy Bentham. He's one of the few philosophers whose doctrines never did any harm, but on the whole did nothing but good." I thought this was a very interesting thing, and he said, "Oh, compare him with Hegel, for example," and sort of shook his head in despair. And it is quite true that if the tree is known by its fruits, well then the Benthamism is infinitely to be preferred to Hegelianism, which gave us Marxism and Prussianism and all kinds of horrors, whereas Bentham gave us Chadwick and decent sewage systems and proper municipal government and things like that, all of which are wholly to the good.
Won't you say something about D.H. Lawrence?
I met Lawrence during the war, and of course I knew him best later on in the last 4 years of his life, from 26 to 30. He was perfectly extraordinary as a human being. He was extremely fascinating, and he was always stimulating, a little alarming to be with. I mean, because he was very fond of my first wife, and we got on very well, and I think we were among the relatively few people with whom he didn't one time or another have a quarrel, and we saw, as I say, a great deal of him in the last 4 years of his life.
Why was he always quarreling?
Well, he was a prickly man, and I don't know, he somehow did it on principle, I feel. I don't know if that's wrong. I don't know what he... It was a very strange thing. He would sort of burst out in this curious way against people. But it was always a pleasure to be with him and to hear his comments on things, his reactions to nature and so on. Were always very, very fascinating.
But some of the things he said seemed to me quite horrifying. For example, his resistance to the intellect.
Well, of course, I never understood his anti-intellectualism, all the more so as he was an intellectual. I mean, as a young man, he'd been a great passer of examinations, and he had a great store of knowledge. He didn't really like to say so, but he did. He was very well read. Of course, one of the things I often speculate, what on earth would have happened if he'd lived on to a reasonable age? It is, of course, it's absolutely extraordinary to think that this man who died at 44 produced this immense volume of stuff, which he did, some of which is very fine, I think. I mean, I do think the short stories and some of the long novelettes are most remarkable, and some of the longer novels, I don't think all of them are successful by any means, and some of the later poems, I think, are very beautiful. But it's amazing to think of all this having been produced by this man who died at 44 and was sick for a great deal of the time. But where would he have gone from the point that he was at when he died? This is a very interesting speculation. I don't think he could have remained where he was, because, I mean, there's a certain ambivalence even in a book like The Plumed Serpent, where he's inviting us to go back to the dark gods and the blood and so on. But in the next breath he's saying how awful the Mexicans are because they're so slow and unintelligent and so on.
I mean, it's a very odd book. I mean, you get the tirades against the Mexicans almost in the terms of an English colonel talking about the natives. In the next breath, you get then these tremendous invitations to sink yourself in the blood. So that there was even then a kind of ambivalence. I think he would have come round to what seems to me a more balanced view. I mean, this whole thing that we have to make the best of both worlds. I mean, both worlds are in us. We have the world of blood and the dark gods. I mean, there was this curious... how many years was it? I mean, well, it was 8 years of wandering between 1918 and 26 when I didn't see him, because he was wandering all over the globe then, hoping to find this... kind of promised land, which was obviously not there. I mean, he was very charming generally. I mean, he would sometimes sort of get cross, but he could be very amusing and entertaining. And he was happy. I mean, he was happy sort of sitting on a stone and very like, remember that poem of Wordsworth, Expostulation and Reply, sitting on an old grey stone as he said. And of course a lot of his life was spent in this way, and then he would get an urge to write and then write for 18 hours a day. I mean, it was very extraordinary to see him at work. It was a sort of possession. He would rush on this, his hand moving at a tremendous rate, and never correct anything, because if he was dissatisfied he would start again from the beginning. His capacity for perception is it was a great pleasure and instruction really to go for a walk with Lawrence. I mean, the sort of way he perceived the world was so intense and exciting. The point is that you must have both. I mean, the blood and the flesh are there, and in certain respects they are wiser than the intellect. I mean, if we interfere with the blood and the flesh with our conscious mind, we get psychosomatic troubles. But on the other hand, we have to do a lot of things with the conscious mind. Why can't we do both? I mean, we have to do both. This is the whole art of life, of making the best of all the worlds. Here again is one of these fatal examples of trying to make everything conform to the standards of only one world, which is perfectly, seeing that we are amphibians, it's no good. These were perverse sides of him, there's no doubt about it. But then... I think he would have sort of gradually emerged from this curiously one-sided view of life and attempt to make all life conform to one kind of a pattern. I feel now that, you know, obviously the sensual side of man is of immense importance, but again, this is the question of making the best of both worlds. This is the problem is, how do we get it, reconcile it with consciousness? How do we become fully aware of it? How do we integrate it into our lives? I mean, this is the important problem. And of course, it's interesting to see what has been done historically in this field to achieve precisely this. I mean, this is the interest, for example, of such things as Tantra in India and Tibet. I mean, this is an attempt to find means whereby the spirituality, quotes, can be expressed and discovered in terms of the ordinary processes of life, including the sensual processes. I mean, this to me is the supreme doctrine now. I mean, the whole Mahayana approach of the summing up of the doctrine, which says that nirvana and samsara are one, the world of liberation and the world of appearances are identical, provided you can find eternity within time. I mean, people like Blake knew all about this, and we're attempting to do it, and this it seems to me is the essence of the art of life, that discovering these methods of finding, so to say, the absolute in the relative, the timeless in the temporal, the spiritual within the world of sense and matter. And I don't think it's impossible. I mean, I think that this is the whole art of living, which again is part of the of this thing which I feel to be supremely important, of making the best of both worlds, of finding out how to harmonize these disparate elements in the human being. And of course, if you had marriage as an institution and this other thing breaking in and smashing the institution, well, then obviously you got into trouble. When passion was completely divorced from marriage and broke up marriage, well, then necessarily it seemed a kind of diabolic possession almost. I mean, passion seemed, for the Greeks spoke about it, I mean, arte in Homer, meaning the state of mind which leads to disaster. In the tragedians, it just means disaster, but in Homer it means the state of mind leading to disaster. And Arte was a daughter of Zeus, whom Zeus, for his own strange and practical joke-like purposes, used to let loose on people. I mean, Arte was the person who blinded Agamemnon into stealing Achilles' girl from him, and when they reconcile, he apologizes and says, "But it wasn't I who did it; it was Arte who did it." And Achilles says, "Yes, of course it was. Arte is really very serious." And if you had this idea, I mean, the sexual passion was just one of the manifestations which this mischievous daughter of Zeus, who could possess you. One of the ones that she imposed upon human beings. They can now blame it, fortunately, on their complexes and the mothers having not weaned them properly or something of the kind. I mean, in fact, it is now the conception of the unconscious, isn't it, that we use instead. But what the Freudians don't use is the counterpart in Greek, in Homeric literature, which is menos, which is the divine capacity to do the impossible. You're suddenly filled with this sort of inspiration. Even horses get it sometimes. I mean, a horse gets so much menos that he can gallop along at a terrific rate, and you.